¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
It's Monday's 50-50 football. Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons with you. I'm being joined by a variety of different people over the phone. We're talking, John, I believe, about Swansea, Leighton Orient and Manchester City.
That's the plan at the moment, although aims have been concrete, plans have been sand today. It feels very much like one of those days. But we're definitely talking about Swansea because Guito's on the line.
Guito's on the line right now. Guito, I don't really want to talk about Liverpool's shortcomings, but I'm sorry we couldn't have won yesterday to help you out, but try not to hold it against us as we record from this studio. But Swansea did get their act together. An early goal helps everybody. But one of the things that I took from it and took from sort of the Swansea people I follow on Twitter is that the whole ground was bouncing really right the way through the 90 minutes.
Yeah. It was a must-win game. And I'm not somebody who uses that term lightly. I think it's one of the most overused terms in football, if I'm honest. But if we had lost yesterday, it would have been very, very difficult to see how we could have stayed up, really, because we all had a feeling that how we're going to beat Watford too. Everybody realised the importance of the game and fair play. You know, the crowd, which hasn't always done its bit, they really turned up yesterday. The early goal definitely helped. I mean, you know, when you are up that early in a game, then obviously that helps sustain the momentum. And obviously, you know, there were things which went our way, got a little bit of luck. So that obviously always helps keep the atmosphere good. But no, it made a very nice change.
Is it also, when we last spoke, it was 2 weeks ago, and one of the things that we talked about was Llorente. And, you know, I think one of the things that helps there is that it's not just that it's an early goal, but it's Sigurdsson laying a goal on for Llorente. And that, you know, as a crowd, we're not stupid, that you suddenly get to see think to yourself, this is our way home in general. This is what gets, if we stay up this season, it's this which keeps us up. And I just sort of think that has a massive knock-on effect for everybody as well. The thing that should be working for us, look, it's working.
Yeah, that first goal was basically our entire attacking strategy for the season summed up in one move, really. Set piece goal from, crossed in from Sigurdsson, and then Llorente heads it into the net. That's what we've been doing all season. And I think one of our big, like I said last time, one of our big problems in the last few weeks with, our poor form is that Llorente either hasn't been playing, or when he has been playing, certainly hasn't been fit. He definitely wasn't fully fit against Stoke on Saturday either, but he did look a lot more comfortable. He had a little bit more movement. That header, of course, you know, he attacked it really well, and generally he had a decent game before he was taken off just before the hour mark. But you're right. I mean, that goal just helped settle everyone down and gave them that little bit of breathing space, took a bit of the pressure off. And yeah, like I said, that is what we've been doing all season, really, is Gylfi Sigurdsson crossing for Llorente, and it worked well.
Did he struggle a bit after Llorente went off? I've seen a couple of people mention that it was a bit of a defensive substitution, and you know, maybe a bit of talk that the manager got away with one a bit.
He did get away with one, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you're taking off your target man, and you're bringing on, you're 6 foot, whatever, centre back, with more than half an hour to go, and you're thinking, oh, this is too early to be going this defensive. You're just inviting Stoke to attack for the last third of the match, and to an extent, that's what happened. It did, you know, we eased off Stoke a little bit. That invited them forward, and of course, when they got that penalty, you thought, oh, it's backfired. It's completely backfired. They're going to go 1-1, and then we're going to really struggle to find a winner without Llorente on the pitch. And you could just see this is the day that everything ends, and how secure survival, etc. But of course, we got a massive slice of luck in that minute between the penalty and that deflected goal. And you know, we haven't had that luck very often this season, so it was certainly welcome to see it on Saturday.
And you then go up the other end and score the deflected goal. But in general, there was a lot of talk about Carroll's performance across the 90 minutes. I noticed that he was very, very dynamic in there. He's been a good sign, I think it's fair to say, at the time when you bought him. I think you said you were thinking he was just going to come in and be a squad player. But it's performances like that one where a centre midfielder gets up and down the park and doesn't stop, which can really help a side.
Yeah, and like you said, Carroll surprised us all when you're right. He has slowed down a little bit over recent weeks, but as everybody, really, that's been the big problem. But on Saturday, yeah, he did have more energy in this game. He was helped massively by the fact that Leon Britton was back in the side. It was his first appearance since Paul Clement arrived at the club. And even at 34 years old, you can see he still gets the best out of the players around him. He's just still got that sharpness and that intelligence. You know, his positional play is fantastic. It was very weird seeing him and Joe Allen exchanging tackles. You know, didn't seem right almost after, you know, how they played with each other when both of them were at the same club. But Leon Britton definitely got the best out of everybody else on the pitch just by doing the basics right, getting our passing game a lot more settled and just adding a bit more composure to the midfield. That made a big difference.
Yeah, I mean it's a funny weekend really because you know you as you said Hull won, Crystal Palace won, and I know you said that you were expecting Hull to win, so you just had to keep in touch with them. So does it but in a funny sort of way, you sort of are where you are. I'm sure you know Middlesbrough got absolutely hammered, but I'm sure you kind of you know they're not really concerned for you anymore. Yeah. Anyway, it's dragging one of those teams down. So does it feel like you're in a more positive place than you were on Friday, even though you're kind of in the same position?
Yes, likely. I mean, just getting that win was vital. And there was a feeling that going into the Stoke match, if you don't beat Stoke, then who are you going to beat out of the remaining games? That was one of the big feelings, really. And Stoke, you know, it has to be pointed out, Stoke were poor. They were really mediocre. I don't think they've been much use all season, really, but on Saturday you could see why their fans have been a little bit miffed this season. It's not really working for them, and it's a bit lackluster. We got that win. We like I said, we knew the Hull were going to win against Watford, even when they were down to 10 men. You thought, yeah, they're still going to probably get this win the way things are going for them at the moment. And that's a difficult thing for us. We're just winning. We needed to win just to stay in touch on Saturday. But we did that. On the Crystal Palace thing, I couldn't see them being dragged into it anyway, if I'm honest. So I'll be honest, it wasn't a massively gutting result from my point of view. I know you will see it differently. Mm. But before the game, I thought it was between us and Hull for that remaining spot. If we finish below, we don't need to worry about Middlesbrough. If Middlesbrough finish above us, then we're done whatever happens. There's talk now that Burnley may be getting dragged into it, but with their remaining fixtures, you expect them to get the job done. I still think it's a two-horse race for that remaining relegation spot between ourselves and Hull, and Hull is still big favourites probably, but we've given ourselves a chance now with that win against Stoke.
With sort of one eye on next season, you know, I think that I'd be very surprised if there'd be any change of manager in the summer. Is it important that no matter what happens at this stage, you know, if you do go down, that everybody feels as though, listen, everyone had the best possible go at turning that around since Clement's come in. You know what I mean? Is this an important thing now in terms of bouncing into next season, looking at being more like Newcastle this season than Norwich?
Yeah, there's a way to go down. And in the first half of the season, it looked like we were going down without any kind of fight and in a total mess. Clement has definitely, you know, tidied things up since he's arrived here, and he has got a response from the players. He's made mistakes over the last few weeks, and quite a few Swansea fans have been complaining about it, but we're in a much better position now than we were under Guidolin or Bob Bradley, regardless of which league we're in next season. And yeah, again, if we go down like, you know, without any fight, and as is Middlesbrough's case at the moment, without a win in 2017, then yeah, obviously the fans are going to be down and feel a bit let down. Let's face it, you know, I'm not questioning the players' fight in general anymore. I think they do want it. Whether or not they're good enough, we'll find out over the remaining four games. But there is a feeling now that they do want it, even if the quality isn't always there.
next weekend you go to United and Hull go to Southampton. Hull play first, which is interesting in that, you know, I think Hull can perhaps approach the whole weekend perhaps thinking they've got a little bit of a free hit. However, that flips, doesn't it?
Do Hull play first? I think it's just...
No, you play the Sunday and they play the Saturday.
That's it.
So they play the 3 o'clock on the Saturday, you've got the 12 o'clock on the Sunday. My point there is, the free hit thing sort of flips, doesn't it? If Hull don't get anything from Southampton, then it's a nice way to go to Manchester United, knowing, well, listen, the worst case scenario is we come out of it and the status quo remains the same. I think it's quite an interesting sort of, at this point of the season, these dynamics come into play.
They do. And earlier on the season, you don't really pay much attention to it because usually there are more teams involved as well in the relegation battle earlier on the season. But by now, it's all about trying to get those little edges on the teams around you. And obviously, if Hull lose against Southampton, then that takes all the pressure off of Swansea going into that Man United match. If Hull win and there's a 5-point gap between ourselves and them going into the match at Old Trafford, then you're hoping suddenly for that. Well, you suddenly feel that you need a result at Old Trafford, which is never a good thing. So it could be an absolutely massive weekend, really. We're just left hoping the Southampton can do us a favour. I know Hull's away form hasn't been as good as their home form, but still you get... Well, it's a little bit worrying when they go to somewhere like Southampton. It's somewhere you can see them picking up points.
Yeah, have you got a Southampton shirt? Yes. great set of lads on the South Coast, you know. Great set of lads.
If they win, I'll get a Southampton tattoo.
I'm gonna say just quickly before we let you go, Gito. I know you've got things to go and get on with, but just on it quickly. I mean, you're talking like you very much see yourselves as second favourites. Is that fair? Do you think it's maybe just a little bit too tough now? Certainly, given Hull and Marco Silva's astonishing home form.
Yeah, I think we need a quite substantial improvement still on what we saw on Saturday, if we're going to have a chance. The fixtures we've got left, we've got a few winnable ones, but they're not straightforward. And like you said, Hull's home form and just the momentum that they've got around the club, they seem to be in a really happy place at the moment, and everybody's feeling very confident. Obviously, one bad weekend can change that at this time of the season, but we are second favourites. We know that. We know we're up against it, but hopefully, all we can do is, it's a cliche, but all we can do is keep winning. That was my attitude against Stoke. I wasn't concentrating really on what Hull were doing. We've just got to win and then hope that they slip up and that we can somehow overtake them. But it's going to be difficult, but we've still got a bit of hope, which if you told me back in December that we'd still have hope with four games left to play, I wouldn't have believed you. So I guess that's a small shred of positivity anyway.
It's more than a small shred. As ever, thanks to Gito indeed for taking the time. We'll be speaking to him again, I'm sure, between now and the end of the season. And now we're going to go and have a chat, presumably about Leighton Orient, but it's exciting today. Anything could happen. So not Leighton Orient, John. It's been that sort of day.
Yeah, we'll do Leighton Orient later in the week. I was chatting to the guy we were going to use, and he said basically this problem isn't going anywhere, so don't worry. Yeah, they're not getting reprieved on Wednesday, unfortunately, Leighton Orient. So we'll do Leighton Orient later in the week.
Leighton Orient later in the week. So we're joined now by Steve Tudor at the Daisy Cutter One to talk about Manchester City. And Steve, Manchester City, two big games back-to-back this week, really. I felt as though Guardiola had to win one of them just for the general morale of everybody. He's 0-1 at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Thursday is a win-at-all-cost game anyway, regardless of how yesterday went. But yeah, the feeling was after the game, it's kind of twin-barreled, really. Obviously, negative on both instances. Just felt robbed by refereeing decisions yet again this season, and that's becoming somewhat of a pattern. But also, really surprisingly, just a lot of negativity towards Pep from Blues, of a different nature to what I've kind of felt recently. Until now, it's been frustration, a bit of exasperation, but there was quite a lot of criticism yesterday after the game. Some Blues have just tended to kind of venting now, and they feel like they've had enough of his shortcomings, which I never thought I'd hear myself say.
That's a strange one for me, Steve, because I only watched the highlights, unfortunately, because of, well, the ridiculous scheduling, to be honest. But I have to say, of all of the games I saw you, or the defeats I've seen this season, that was one I would have to say I couldn't really see anything to particularly pin on Pep. I thought that you guys had some great chances in the game. It was another one of those games where capitalise when you're on top and it's a different story. And I don't really think that that necessarily comes down to managerial tactics or substitutions or what have you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I don't know if a lot of it was down to kind of post-match disappointment and just, you know, materialising his anger. But, yeah, I just heard a lot of criticism regarding, you know, our shape, our kind of our performance. Personally, I thought it was okay. It was perfectly fine. I mean, it's hard to gauge when you're at Wembley, and it's hard to gauge in, you know, a semi-final because it's so unique in its nature. Really, you're just looking to get the job done, aren't you? And, and we certainly created enough chances to do that. So I was not in kind of, you know, a critical camp, but I was very surprised at how many Blues were.
Do you think just, I mean, he's such a well-renowned manager and expectations were so high when he came in, and he's kind of fed that because he's been so successful. And do you think he's obviously made the decision to have a look at most plays? He wasn't quite as wholesale in the summer as people thought. He was pretty ruthless with his goalkeeper. But aside from that, you know, there've been a lot of players who maybe Man City fans would have moved on last summer who were still around and are still getting a chance. And do you think, kind of based on that, that really the expectations have been a little, you know, just too high based on the name? Or do you think even with that, you probably should have done a bit better this season?
Well, I mean, look at our fullbacks yesterday. It's Navas and Clichy, who, you know, was good back in the day. But when we're playing Arsenal, you've got to consider that, you know, there were surplus requirements, really, at Arsenal. They were happy to, well, they weren't happy to let him go, but let's say that they were far more reluctant to let Nasri go than Clichy. And he was in their team, what, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
So just even looking at the fullbacks, it's kind of a bit confounding. I think some criticism is warranted for last summer's kind of recruitment policy, but much more kind of criticism is warranted when you look further back, because for 3, 4, 5 years now, City have wanted Pep, and behind the scenes, they've been convinced that they're going to get Pep. And all City fans have heard when we've been signing players is, this is with one eye on when Pep gets here. We're preparing for Guardiola. Well, you look at Sterling, for example. I mean, that was a classic example of, you know, word reached us that, you know, Pep had approved of this. He wanted, you know, Raheem and Brian too, exactly the same situation. But then you look at the other signings, you know, players who are just kind of mediocre, just kind of stopgap signings. And it's kind of amounted to a squad now in severe need of an overhaul at a time when we've got the manager that we've craved for so long. So it's not that we've put everything in place for him. You know, quite the opposite, in fact. You know, we've now got a squad aging, you know, with flaws right throughout the squad, desperately in need of a huge overhaul. So that's where the criticism should lie, I think, kind of, you know, in the recruitment by Cheeky Bisterskine rather than Pep Guardiola.
Is there going to be some sort of, and you mentioned there that there's, you know, the sort of size of the overhaul, and to me it's one of the things that makes the summer so interesting from an outsider's point of view, is that he's left with needing to do that overhaul now sort of in person, and maybe that's sort of what he wanted. Maybe it was the idea that he wants to come and have a look at everyone, but he's simultaneously lost that sort of, or is in the process of losing that sort of feel good. It's Pep Guardiola, it's a new era, bounce, if you know what I mean. So it's become this a bit of a mishmash of a season. I'm still of the view, I think he wasn't expecting it to be quite as difficult as it has been. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, absolutely. That feel-good bounce is gone, mate. I mean, I really think now it's almost a turnaround is required, and, you know, something he's never faced before, whether he has kind of kind of mental fortitude to do that is anyone's guess. But certainly now he's in a situation that he's never encountered before. You look back at the start of the season and the unbeaten games and the cracking start we had, and everything was going so well, and he had these inverted fullbacks and it was working a treat, and then suddenly he's just three at the back, and it all just started to go pear-shaped, and there was stubbornness there, definitely there was stubbornness. I mean, some say he basically tried to just improve us or kind of, you know, progress us at a far quicker pace than what the players could kind of keep up with. And but it was certainly noticeable that there was less rotation as the season went on, and he went back to kind of basics to an extent, and then results improved consequently. So, yeah, he's made mistakes. He's tried to do too much too soon. And it's bit him. It really has, because now he's got a big turnaround. I mean, it's not just a turnaround of personnel this summer. He's lost his kind of his stature, his status, which, let's face it, you know, is a huge benefit to any manager to have that kind of stature when he walks into a dressing room.
It's an interesting one for me, Steve, because I think this summer, I mean, we say it every year, but this summer, in terms of recruitment, is going to be so important, because not only are pretty much every team in the top six looking to need to improve, but a lot of them are looking in the same positions at the same players. Mm. And like you say, Guardiola losing that aura could come at a very inopportune time, especially when you've got Antonio Conte, who's basically been able to come and do what everyone thought Pep was going to be able to do, which is win it all in his first season.
Absolutely, because it's not, obviously it's not just the club you signed for, it's the coach as well. And Conte now is a much bigger draw. Klopp is a bigger draw than Guardiola, which wasn't the case, I don't think, last summer. You know, now he is, I think. But there's certain managers whose reputation and their stock rise, some down. It's just, you know, it fluctuates like with everything else in life. So Guardiola this summer, he's basically got to convince players to come to City, whereas maybe last summer, just his name alone would have kind of secured a signature. As what you were saying about the top six and all looking at the same players, I think we're in for a fascinating summer. I mean, a real proper soap opera of the summer. And basically the type of summer that we hoped for last year, which just didn't materialise. It was United who were basically, you know, with Pogba and Ibrahimovic. You look through the other clubs and our signings, they're more pragmatic than anything else. I think this year it's going to be huge amounts of money spent on some big names and very, very competitive for the same players, as you said.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it is going to be an interesting one. And I mean, jumping back to the game itself, you know, we're talking about, you know, things that the manager could have done better, but it looked to me like if the referee had made decisions that he should have, you'd have won the game anyway, and no one's kind of talking about that. And it has been a strange... I obviously, you know, follow a few City fans on Twitter, in particular your writing, and you've tried to kind of get your head around how you can have so many bad decisions in a row, and how City can be, you know, punished so much, really. I noticed Yaya Toure coming out and saying he'd rather play with no referee on Thursday, you know, just kind of take your chances on it. I mean, that'll be quite entertaining in a Manchester derby, don't get me wrong, but I'm not sure he's going to necessarily get his wish. But I mean, I know you've written stuff on it, Steve, so just kind of your opinion on the reasons, maybe. Is it just purely bad luck? Is there any kind of conspiracy theories going around that kind of, you know, to you, kind of have a little bit of weight?
Well, I mean, I'm just talking personally here, and it's hard to kind of say that, sounding a bit kind of arrogant, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and yet I now believe in a conspiracy. So if I believe in a conspiracy, someone who wasn't a conspiracy theorist, surely that says something, that, you know, there is something to be concerned about, or at least kind of look at. Because I used to kind of look at the kind of, you know, the agenda talk by City fans and just think, oh, come on, it does. I used to believe in that whole notion of it evens out over the course of the season and all the rest of it. Not. It really just feels so weird right now, where in every big game, because I'm only talking about when we're playing the top six, because that's when these decisions come to the fore.
Mm.
And so when you're taking on Arsenal in a FA Cup semi, all I was thinking about before the game was, please let there not be a weird decision today. Just be fair. Just have, you know, and I'm not talking about kind of us getting more fouls given against us in the opposition or whatever. I'm talking about weird decisions. Now, yesterday's wasn't a weird one. It was incompetence on the linesman's behalf. But bear in mind, this is the same linesman who didn't see Kyle Walker shove Raheem Sterling in the box when we played Tottenham. An instant that, you know, people, neutrals were watching thinking, what? How can he miss that? So I don't believe that it's a conspiracy. I'm certainly at that point now where I'm suspicious. It's really, really odd.
I think the standard of refereeing at the moment, Steve's the worst I've seen it. I think there's a number of factors in that. I think it's partially because, for instance, in the big games this season,
certainly the ones that I think Liverpool and City have been involved in, I think that they're played at such a pace at times. I think that the referees are, and this isn't me doing a Ferguson, Alan Wiley, I think the referees are just struggling to keep up, and that they're having to make so many decisions so quickly, it's having a knock-on effect. I think that that's one problem, because I think that, you know, you look at the way in which, you know, for instance, you use the game at the Etihad's one of the fastest games of football I've ever seen, when Man City played Liverpool. And so the idea of refereeing in that scenario, I think, becomes very difficult indeed. And I think that the referee that day is actually, you know, I think you can broadly speaking look at his body of work and say that you think he's a reasonably good referee. I don't think he's great by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that up and down the country, a number of these fellows, I just don't think they're very good. And I think it's becoming very, very tough to say otherwise, to be honest with you. I think that, you know,
you don't want to think of it as being kind of any form of purposeful agenda, because then really, you know, what you're suggesting there, you're suggesting ludicrous. But at the same time, you also look at other leagues across Europe and you look at kind of recent history and you see that, you know, such things do go on, but you just don't like to think of it in England. And again, it seems farcical to suggest that, you know, such kind of wrongdoings go on at such a level.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be anything kind of dodgy, does it? It's often a case of, you know, you wonder whether in big games, do you think maybe in the back of the mind, referees think, oh, I can upset Man City, but I'm not upsetting Man United, or I'm not upsetting Chelsea. And I think, or maybe even Liverpool, I don't know. But I wonder whether, you know, there's this thing where there's certain football clubs that referees are more concerned about upsetting than others. And I wonder whether that comes into play. And that's not anything dodgy. And that's not, you know, something that, you know, it's not corruption. It's just kind of something that is frustrating and something that might happen. And you see it, you know, we've seen it at Old Trafford in the past and things like that.
Absolutely. We saw it several times with Ferguson. And, you know, that's one thing he brought to the table there. You know, United's fully capitalised on that, the fact that he had this intimidation, you know, where referees were scared of him. And so, yeah, that's definitely going to be a factor, I think. And also just the fact that City aren't a particularly popular football club within that, you know, the hierarchies of football. And so that factors in too, just kind of unconscious decision-making that, you know, kind of goes against us. Not the referees thinking, right, I'm going to do you here, but just kind of, you know, subconscious. So, yeah, that's where I lie anyway. I certainly don't think that it's some outright conspiracy. But like I said, I'm just at that stage now where I'm thinking this is getting really, really strange now.
No, I have to agree with you there, Steve, regarding the pressure that certain clubs exert and the way that, because I think a lot of the time you'll be able to tell by if it's a referee who's not giving decisions, if he's kind of giving rash decisions as in red cards that aren't really a red card or penalties that aren't really penalties, then that's different. But if he's scared to make a decision, so he's not making a decision by not giving it, then I think those are the kind of instances where you start to think, well, yeah, influence is starting to kick in here.
Well, I don't know quite who's putting that pressure on, if you know what I mean. I know that Mourinho had a kickoff early this season and United have benefited from a few sort of offside decisions, but even that though, he got punished for the kickoff. It wasn't an old style sort of, he said something and got away with it. I'm not really looking at, you know, I can't see where and if Conte is putting pressure on officials. If anything, I've seen Klopp go more berserk at fourth officials than anyone else in the country in a few senses.
Well, sometimes it's not even just the management. For me, I think it's us. It's the people who sit and debate and kind of tear these people's, because essentially this is their career and they're getting torn apart in papers and on the internet and everywhere up and down the country. And there are certain teams which have more scrutiny than others. Even someone like Match of the Day tries to give as much weight to each individual team. If there's a big game and a big decision, they'll definitely get more weight on it.
I think that's definitely the case if there's a big game and a big decision. But then that's where I think it goes the other way in that. If there's a big game and there's a big decision and you don't make it, then everyone will call you for that. Whereas, you know, the referees, et cetera. I don't know. I actually think, I'll be honest, and I'll say, I think that given some of what I've seen in terms of post-match interviews, some of the refereeing I've seen this season, I actually think managers have been relatively restrained at times. I include Guardiola in that, by the way, Steve. I'm not just, you know, I think that there's a number of managers up and down the country who I think would have had a real case to absolutely, you know, go berserk post-match, and in times gone by might have done. Yet I think there's been a lot of managers sort of going, listen, I'm just trying not to say anything now.
Well, Marco Silva on the weekend was a classic example. I mean, obviously it helped the fact that Hull City still won.
Always helps when you win.
Could you imagine if they'd not won that game, Swansea and everyone else had won, and that could have been the 3 points that became fatal?
Exactly, no, exactly. But that's a really good example, because I don't believe, I don't think we're knocking around thinking that the powers that be don't want to upset Watford. Do you know what I mean? I don't think the powers that be don't want to upset Watford, but that's a really bad decision. It's a really, really bad decision. And that fella's running up and down the country and has been refereeing a number of matches, including at Anfield this season, where I think he's been really, really poor. I think he's been really, really poor. And he might be a nice fella, and I believe he came over really nicely on that documentary. But I think he's been really, really poor all season. And I don't think for a second it's any... And as I say, that's both poor to Liverpool and to whoever Liverpool's opponents have been when I've seen it. But that's an example of him just not being that good at his job. And I just sort of wonder, Steve, whether or not we've got ourselves somehow into a pickle where we've got a sort of like a class or a generation of referees where there's barely, you know, there's only about four or five of them that if I see refereeing a game which I've got an interest in, I think, oh, this will be all right. There's a number of them where I think this could quickly get out of hand.
Absolutely. I mean, we're looking at the derby ahead on, you know, Thursday, and Michael Oliver's name's been mentioned. It hasn't been confirmed yet. And I'm kind of okay with that, you know. He's, in my mind, he's one of the better referees. You know, he has his flaws, certainly. And when he first started out, I thought he was kind of a bit cowardly at times, but he's kind of grown into becoming a decent referee. And we're getting to that stage now, as you said, where you're looking ahead and you're looking at who's refereeing, and there's four or five names, and you think, it reassures you. You think, even if they make decisions, you know, or go against you, you know it's coming from the right place. They can back that up with some kind of judgment there. Whereas, I honestly don't think the ref knew what he was doing at the weekend. The kind of occasion was too big for him. It swallowed him up. He lost control. I mean, don't get me wrong, Arsenal should have had a pen. It wasn't, you know, just all out against Manchester City.
This is what I think.
It was a diabolical performance by the referee in an FA Cup semi-final. So then you have to look at, you know, the people who chose him for that game. And so they kind of too. So, yeah, it's the situation of refereeing is farcical right now, considering the money and the status of the Premier League, and something really has to be done about it.
Okay. Always good to speak to you, Steve. Steve, you're going to get a result on Thursday. Give me a prediction just out of interest.
I think we're going to win 3-1.
3-1. Okay. Excellent stuff. Excellent. All right. We'll find out what's happening next. And because that's all today on 50-50 football. More in a second. Good to speak to Steve there. It's a funny sort of picture now up and down the league, to be honest with you, Mo. The top six is with Arsenal and Man United trying to hunt down Liverpool and City. That's tightened up, and it's the whole Swansea battle. I mean, that they're now the defining battles. But we're all sort of glossing over the fact that Chelsea beat Spurs at the weekend. We all thought it might have a psychological impact, and Chelsea won 4-2, and it feels like it may well be significant. The next two games, Chelsea have got Southampton at home, Spurs have got Palace away. I know who I'd rather be.
Very much so. I think for Spurs as well, with the coming of Arsenal on the horizon, they're going to be even under more pressure to make sure that they can get back on track against Palace. Palace, who, by the way, have beaten Arsenal, Chelsea and Liverpool in the space of a month. So they're in pretty good form themselves.
John, it felt like one that Spurs had to win, and you can read too much into body language. And listen, footballers are always going to look dejected walking off of Wembley when they've not won, if we're all honest about it. But Spurs, they just looked a bit bruised and battered to me.
Yeah, it felt like they'd sort of thrown everything at it and come up short. And I think that can be almost more demoralising than when you just haven't played well. And I think the big players came to the party, you know, both Kane and Ali both scored. You know, the second one's a terrific assist from Eriksen. I mean, you could just sort of watch it all day. And that would worry me if I was a Spurs fan, because you don't want the likes of Harry Kane to start thinking, is this where to win things? Because, you know, it's been so positive for Spurs, you know, for a while now, but they haven't managed to get a trophy. And, you know, they talk as a football club about, well, that needs to change soon. And I'm not saying that, you know, the players are going to be handing the transfer request this summer or anything. I don't think it'll happen quite like that. But maybe if doubts start to creep into minds and they start to think, well, you know, is this a football club where I can win things, or have I got to kind of move on somewhere else? And that could be a problem, as I say, when your big players perform and it's still not quite enough.
I think, to be honest, You can still make a good case for Spurs having made progress this season.
No, definitely. Huge progress.
And I mean, even within that game, the fact that in the previous years, if you look at the score, say 4-2, then think, oh, well, that's a bit of a one-sided match. But they went down and then they came back. And then they went down and then they came back. They couldn't do it a third or fourth time. But the fact that they were able to do it twice is in itself significant for me. I think in terms of the players' heads being turned, it's only if any of the big clubs make a serious move. I mean, obviously there's been rumours about Barcelona looking into Eriksen, but then Barcelona currently looking to anyone who looks at it like he could be a little bit like Iniesta. So I think that there's a little bit of pinch of salt to be taken with that. But they look like a team who trusts their manager when he speaks. And that speaks volumes.
I think that's massive, but I think he's got a big job, hasn't he, John, between now and Wednesday in terms of picking them back up. But yes, they've got an extra day's rest than Palace, and it'll be huge for them if they can get a result. But Conte gambled, trusted his squad, whichever way it wants to be phrased, and he's got the result that he wants, which means that, you know, it's for him, it's the easiest dressing room in the world at the moment.
Yeah, it is easy for them now in terms of, you know, getting people up, because he's proved, you know, the squad's maybe a little bit deeper than what people thought. You know, lots of people have said, oh, they've been lucky with injuries this season and things like that. You know, not in Europe, they've been able to put the same team out. When I saw that Chelsea team, I was a bit worried for them, really. I thought, oh, it doesn't look strong enough. And then they win 4-2 and, you know, score early and things like that. And other players kind of step up when need be, which is what's happened all season, really, with Chelsea. Is different players have stepped up at different times when they've been needed. And so, yeah, it's going to be a very confident dressing room now going into the last few games of the season. And they just need to keep the train going for a few more weeks, and they'll be they might have a double.
I think so. I think the idea at the moment is that they're more likely to lose the FA Cup than the league, and that's even given Arsenal's record against Chelsea in big games. But the interesting thing for me is that because I remember looking at the team sheet, seeing, oh yeah, no Costa, no Hazard, and thinking, oh, he's rattled. He wants to save these guys because he knows that the league is super important. And that was a big psychological plus for Spurs. But obviously, what he's done is that he's kind of looked at his squad and thought, okay, there's a couple of guys here who need to be reminded of how important they are. Willian being a classic example, because he pretty much carried them last season on his own.
Yeah.
So then to find himself out on his ear in this brave new world of Chelsea must have been quite hard for him to take. So to keep him on side, and to not only do that, but he gave him so much responsibility within the game, like insisting that he took the penalty. He proved to William, say, look, I value you. You're important to me. When you come in, I need you to perform. And he did it to that letter.
Okay. Thank you very much this week to Mo and to John, obviously, and to Steve. And to Gito as well for taking some time earlier today. This has been this week's 50-50 football. Loads and loads of games midweek, though. Should be a cracker on Thursday.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.